The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Donna Gerson. I'm co-chair of the Pepper Council, a group of dedicated supporters of the Free Library of Philadelphia. And in my work day, I'm the associate dean at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, where we're celebrating 10 years producing practice-ready lawyers. So as many of you know, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. From its award-winning author series to its thought-provoking programs, please visit freelibrary.org/support to make a gift, a meaningful gift that will help the library continue to produce transformative programming. And while you're online, don't forget to sign up for a library card. Everyone should have one of these in a civil society, and I use mine every single week. So it's now my pleasure to welcome literary luminary Jonathan Safran Foer back to the Free Library. The Brooklyn-based writer has said he writes about things he would want to read, not out of desire to write itself. This formula has led to the veritable masterworks, Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which millions of other people wanted to read as well. Both were also made into powerhouse films. The library was thrilled to host him after the publications of both of these books, as well as for his best-selling nonfiction book, Eating Animals, and his new American Haggadah, co-authored with Nathan Englander. He currently teaches creative writing at New York University. His eagerly awaited new novel, which is for sale upstairs, is called Here I Am, and it is his first in 11 years. It is an epic yet intimate tale of a Washington, D.C. family confronted by questions of identity and fulfillment when a devastating earthquake escalates conflict in both the Middle East and their own home. In its first week on sale, it has garnered high praise internationally and here at home. The Times Literary Supplement in London hails, quote, Foer is an absolute master of his fictional universe. In Here I Am, he has found a place to put anything and everything. On NPR's Fresh Air, the critic Maureen Corrigan, who is also a friend of the Free Library, called it dazzling and a profound novel about the claims of identity, history, family, and the burdens of a broken world. And the New York Times praises it as Foer's best and most caustic novel, filled with so much pain and regret that your heart sometimes struggles to hold it all. Once put down, it begs to be picked back up again. So we are so pleased to have him back with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jonathan Safran Foer to the Free Library.
Hello, it's really, really nice to be back. I don't remember exactly how many years it's been, but it feels like it's been a long time. And when I was sitting down maybe 6 months ago, 9 months ago, with the publishing house and the publicist who organizes the tour said, you know, before we even begin thinking about this, are there any places you would really love to go where you've had particularly good experiences? And I, of course, thought of this place. It was the first place that I thought of. And I say that because it's not, I say that as a thank you, because it's not an accident that I've had such good experiences here. I've had such good experiences because this program is so well organized and so much thought is put into it and so much energy. And writers, and I know other writers, we discuss such things, feel really lucky to be able to speak here. So I want to thank everybody who works at the library and worked to put this together. My book, this novel, Here I Am, came out in Italy, oddly enough, before it came out in America. So I was in Italy for about a week, and I was in Milan for a good part of that. And it was a very busy time. But I found myself with about half an hour free one day, and my publisher asked if there's anything that I wanted to do in Milan. And I said, well, I've always really wanted to see The Last Supper. Is there any chance I could go do that? And he said, well, it's not that simple, because you have to have tickets and a reservation. You don't just walk in. It's not like a normal museum. But you're a very important American author. So, you know, remember, in places, the rest of the world, they either despise us or they love us, oftentimes both at the same time. And in Europe, they still kind of do like the idea of American authors for whatever reason. Very important American author. I'm going to take care of this. So I got really chuffed and was feeling kind of cool. And that night I was FaceTiming with my kids and I was like, guess who's going to cut in line to see The Last Supper? Your dad, the great American author. Oh, great wasn't a word he used, actually. Important American author. And they're like, well, when's The Last Supper? It's like, you know, that Da Vinci painting, which I think is a painting. Maybe it's a mosaic. Again, I never got to see it. That's the punchline of the story. Well, why would you want to see that? And I said, well, because, you know, it's like Jesus Christ is in it, and so? And, well, it's like, it's a Passover Seder, and you guys, yeah, but we don't even want to go to our own Passover Seders. And I guess I felt a welling of pride, probably, in terms of, like, giving them a good set of priorities. In any case, my publisher came back the next morning. He said, well, you are an important American author, but it wasn't that easy. But I can get you in to see Michelangelo's Pietà. And I said, well, I was warned that this is sensitive. I said, that's really great. That's great. I'm excited. And he said, well, it's actually not the Pietà you're thinking of. That one's in the Vatican. But this is also very much worth seeing. So, all right, let's go see that. Little party favor. So we went to see it, and it has its own museum really dedicated to it. And it's very beautifully laid out in such a way that you have to, its back faces you when you walk in. So you really have to confront it yourself and experience it yourself. And it was the last sculpture that Michelangelo made. There's some debate about whether it's finished or unfinished. It's the only sculpture he made that wasn't commissioned, that he made for himself. And it's a very beautiful and haunting piece of art. And one of the odd, beautiful, and haunting things about it is that there are two figures but five limbs. There's a fifth arm, excuse me, and five arms. And the fifth arm is sort of a little bit off to the side. The two figures are here, and they're embracing, and then the fifth arm is off to the side. And it was explained to me by the docent that, you know, Michelangelo had originally probably conceived of three or four figures or more in the sculpture. And I said, well, why didn't he just get rid of the arm? Because it looks so strange. And she said, because the center of gravity of the sculpture depends on that arm. And if he were to get rid of that arm, the sculpture would topple. And in art historical terms, that's called a regret. That the moment in a subtractive sculpture, obviously if you're making something out of clay, just as if you're writing a novel, you're free to add and remove whatever you want. Nothing is at stake. But with subtractive sculpture, when you rethink something but are unable to then make the change, it's called a regret. And I spent a little bit of time, the time that I had, thinking about that, looking at the sculpture from every angle. And as we were leaving, the docent said to me, and I think she was unaware of the fact that she was echoing that word, she said, you know, one of the last things that Michelangelo wrote in his life was, my life's greatest regret is that I worked so hard on my art and I worked so little on my life. I spent so much time working on my art and so little time working on my life. So this novel, Here I Am, is filled with that first kind of regret. It is a sort of overstuffed book. It shows a lot of process. There are fingerprints all over it, and the glue and the tape and the seams. You can see how it is held together, and I want you to. I don't know why I want you to. I want you to because that's the way that I like it. And taste, if that's even the right word, it's probably something even a little bit more primitive than taste, isn't really responsive to explanation or to language. And I know that I feel the same way as a reader as I do as a writer. But it has a lot in it. There are a lot of arguments in it. There's probably an argument on every single page, but I don't think of the book as having an argument. There's a lot of politics in the book, different kinds of politics. The book is geopolitical, and the book is domestically political, and it's sexually political, but it doesn't have a political argument to make. There are a lot of voices in the book, a lot of perspectives in the book. I don't know if it has any kind of dominant sensibility. Maybe that's something we could talk about tonight. Then I thought about this other kind of regret, the regret of working on art and working on life, and the oddness even of making that distinction. You know, what does that mean? I guess in the most explicit sense, it could mean I was working on my art instead of spending time with other people, or I was working on my art instead of thinking about who I am. I was making, in his case, commissions instead of making what I wanted to make. And even without perfectly understanding that statement or sentiment, I know that this is the first book, or I feel that this is the first book I've written where I didn't have that kind of regret. And that's not to say that the book is in any way therapeutic or cathartic or autobiographical. It's really not, or not any more than my other two books were. Not in the sense of events in the book corresponding to events in life, which is what most people mean when they use the word autobiography. I don't feel more strongly associated with the hero Jacob than I do with the heroes of my other books, or even with the other characters in this book, like his wife Julia, or his children, or his father or grandfather. But there's something about the sum of the voices, all of the other kind of regrets, those like limbs that aren't attached to bodies, something about the accumulation of them that makes me feel a closeness to this book and a kind of a personal relationship to it that I haven't felt with anything that I've written before, which makes it both special and exciting to share and also kind of scary to share. But this is what we do. I'm not a diarist or a journalist. I mean, a journal keeper, rather, but a novelist. And so after having spent, you know, it's been 11 years since I published my last novel. This novel didn't take me 11 years to write. It probably took me 2 or 3 years to write, just like my other books did. It just took me a long time to start, which is something, again, we can talk about later or not. But having spent the time that I did trying to start the book, and then having spent the time that I did working on the book in this singularly personal way, and now shifting gears into something that is public and shared is an experience that I don't think one can exactly prepare oneself for. At least I can't. And so it's been really revelatory and happy and scary. So what I thought I would do is read one passage of the book, not terribly long, and then we'll just have a conversation. In anticipation of giving readings, I started to put together a list of passages I might read, and I sent them to my editor, who's one of my oldest friends. He edited my first book, Everything is Illuminated, and then we weren't able to work together until this book. He said, yeah, I could see how that one would work. And then to each of my own suggestions, I would say, yeah, but it's not representative. It's just going to misrepresent the book. This one isn't represented. This one is like funny, but the book isn't really funny. And this one is kind of tragic, but the book is not a downer. And this one's about marriage, which the book is obviously about, but it's also about this. But then if I read about that, it's not going to cover the domestic stuff. And none of these feel representative. I just don't have a passage I could read that would feel representative. And he said, isn't that the book you wanted to write? And I was really touched by that statement because I felt like he understood me. And in a way, it connects back to that that idea of those like intentional regrets of the kind of muchness that, you know, my greatest ambition in a way for something that I write would be to overhear somebody recommending it and you know, and trying to answer the question, what's it about? Why should I read it? And just being responding only like, you just have to read it. Like, I could tell you what it's about, sort of, but it would kind of miss the point. You just have to read it. So it's my hope that you will just read it. But we don't have enough time to go through the whole thing tonight. So I am going to read an excerpt. And this is a kind of funny excerpt. All you really have to know is that almost all of the book takes place in Washington, D.C. And almost all of it takes place in rooms, in kitchens, in living rooms, in bedrooms. And it's the story of a family, Jacob and Julia Block, who are in their early 40s. And they have three kids, Sam, Max, and Benji, who are 13, 10, and 6. And they are experiencing the kind of dissolution of a marriage, which was precipitated by a discovered cell phone, which had inappropriate texting on it, like seriously inappropriate texting. Really as serious as you can imagine texting being inappropriate. That's how inappropriate it was. But it's actually just, it gives them an occasion to acknowledge something that's been happening over a long period of time, which is a slow withdrawal and a tragic withdrawal from these two people, from each other and from themselves. And part of what makes it tragic is that there was no original crime or sin, or it was hard to know why it began to happen, and once it started to happen, it felt inevitable or impossible to stop. In any case, we stay with this family through the course of 4 weeks, during which their oldest son is supposed to be bar mitzvahed, but he gets in trouble at his school, which there's not time to get into right now, and then international cousins start to arrive for his bar mitzvah, including these Israeli cousins. While everybody's in town, there's an earthquake in the Middle East, a very dramatic one, which precipitates a war, which gets so extreme that the Prime Minister of Israel asks all Jewish men between the ages of 15 and 55 to come to Israel to fight. So there are these two crises which require people to make ultimate choices of identity. Do I stay in this marriage or do I not stay in this marriage? Do I go to Israel to fight or do I admit that ultimately the country is dispensable to me? So this, I'm going to read a scene when Jacob and his middle son, Max, go to the airport to pick up, and his father, Irv, go to pick up Tamir, the Israeli cousin who's just arrived. Tamir is about the same age as Jacob, early 40s. They're kind of foils, they're types, they're caricatures in a way, but I hope they're also realistic. Jacob is an American Jew who is, you know, a TV writer. He's kind of brainy, kind of small, kind of pale, thoughtful, sensitive, good guy. He'll sign your books afterward if you're interested. And then in Israel is Tamir, who is kind of brash, and as Jacob puts it, he never gives a shit. He just doesn't give shits. He's going to tell you what he thinks. He's going to be upfront. He's not going to butt in line, but nobody's going to butt in front of him. Very muscular in sort of all senses of the word. Quite masculine. So the only other character I haven't explained is Jacob's father, Irv, who is a kind of unconditional Zionist to the point of being sort of xenophobic. He is funny and I think quite sympathetic. Is sometimes written obviously as a caricature, and sometimes I think takes a lot of and deserves a lot of the reader's warmth. So they're at the airport, and Jacob has just gone to the restroom. A man his father's age was urinating beside him. His pee came out in bursts, as if from a lawn sprinkler, and to Jacob's unaccredited ear, it sounded like a symptom. When the man let out a small grunt, Jacob reflexively glanced over, and they exchanged the briefest of smiles before remembering where they were, a place where exactly one extremely brief moment of acknowledgement was tolerable. Jacob had the strong sensation that he knew this person. He often felt that at urinals. I don't know why women are laughing. That's an experience you've never had. Probably. He often felt that at urinals, but this time he was sure, as he always was. Where had he seen that face before? Is it one of his teachers from grade school, or maybe one of the boys' teachers? One of his father's friends? He was momentarily convinced that the stranger was a figure in one of Julia's old family photos from Eastern Europe, and that he'd traveled through time to deliver some kind of warning. Jacob returned to thoughts of babbling brooks and the slow death of a lower back whose demise, like so much else, he never considered until forced, and then it hit him. Spielberg. Once the thought appeared, there was just no doubting it. Of course, it was him. Jacob was standing, his penis exposed, next to Steven Spielberg, whose penis was exposed. What were the odds? Jacob had grown up, as had every Jew in the last quarter of the 20th century, under Spielberg's wing, or rather in the shadow of his wing. He'd seen E.T. 3 times in its opening week, all at the Uptown Theater, each time through his fingers as the bike chase reached a climax so delicious it was literally unbearable. He'd seen Indiana Jones and the next one and the next one. He'd tried to sit through Always. Well, nobody's perfect. Not until he makes Schindler's List, at which point he's not even he anymore, but representative of them. Them? The murdered millions. No, Jacob thought, representative of us, the unmurdered. But Schindler wasn't for us, it was for them. Not the murdered, obviously, they can't watch movies. It was for all of them who weren't us, the goyim. Because with Spielberg, into whose bank account the general public was compelled to make annual deposits, we finally had a way to force them to look at our absence, to rub their noses in the German shepherd's shit. And God, was he loved. Jacob found the movie schmaltzy, overblown, and flirting with kitsch. But he had been profoundly moved. Irv denounced the choice to tell an uplifting Holocaust story and to give, for all intents and purposes, a statistically negligible happy ending generated by that statistically negligible of species, the good German. But even Irv had been moved to his limits. Isaac, this is Jacob's grandfather, couldn't have been more moved. You see what was done to us, to my parents, to my brothers, to me, you see? Everyone was moved. And everyone was persuaded that being moved was the ultimate aesthetic, intellectual, and ethical experience. Well, Jacob was going to have to cop a look at Spielberg's penis. The only question was on what pretense. Every annual physical ended with Dr. Schlesinger kneeling in front of Jacob, cupping his balls, and asking him to turn his head and cough. That experience seemed to be universal and universally inexplicable among men. But coughing and turning one's head had something to do with genitals. The logic wasn't airtight, but it felt right. Jacob coughed and snuck a peek. The size didn't make an impression. Spielberg was no longer shorter, wider, or narrower than most doughy Jewish grandfathers. Neither was he particularly bananaed, pendular, reticulated, light-bulbish, reptilian, laminar, mushroomed, varicosey, hook-nosed, or cockeyed. That list, I should really take a moment to thank my little brother. I texted him without any context. I will tell you, to the best of my memory, the content of my text was, I need some adjectives to describe Steven Spielberg's penis. I didn't say for something I'm writing. I didn't say. And I hit within, I'm not even sure I'd hit send when his list started coming through, one after another after another. A number of these words I literally don't know the meaning of. Like laminar. I don't know what that means. But I know it's right. What was notable wasn't what was missing. His penis was uncircumcised. Jacob had had precious little exposure to the visual atrocity that is an intact penis, and so wouldn't bet his life on what he saw. and the stakes felt that high. But he knew enough to know he had to look again. But though urinal etiquette forgives a greeting and the cough might have been a passable alibi for the glance, there was simply no way to return to the scene without propositioning sex. And even in a world in which Spielberg hadn't made AI, that wasn't going to happen. There were four options. One, he'd misidentified him as Steven Spielberg and misidentified his penis as being uncircumcised. Two, he'd misidentified him as Steven Spielberg and correctly identified his penis as being uncircumcised. Three, it was Steven Spielberg, but he'd misidentified his penis as being uncircumcised. Of course he was circumcised. Or four, Steven Spielberg wasn't circumcised. If he were a betting man, he'd push his mountain of chips onto four. Jacob flushed, his face and the urinal, washed too quickly to accomplish anything, and scrambled back out to the others. You're never gonna guess who I just peed beside. Jesus, Dad. Close. Spielberg. Who's that? Tamir asked. You're serious? What? Spielberg, Steven Spielberg. Never heard of him. Give me a break, Jacob said, unsure as ever to what extent Tamir was performing. Whatever else could be said about him, Tamir was smart, worldly, and restless. But whatever else could be said about him, he was foolish, solipsistic, and self-satisfied. If he had a sense of humor, it was drier than cornstarch, which enabled him to practice a kind of psychological acupuncture on Jacob. Did a needle just enter me? Does it hurt? Is this complete bullshit? He couldn't have been serious about Israeli-Italian food. That's a conversation they had earlier. Could he? And about not having heard of Steven Spielberg? It's impossible. And entirely possible. Oh, that's heavy, Irv said. And the heaviest part? Jacob leaned in and whispered, he's not circumcised. Max threw his hands into the air. What, did you kiss his wiener in the bathroom stall? Who is this Spielberg? Tamir asked. We were at urinals, Max. And just to be clear, and of course I didn't kiss his wiener. No, I'm sorry, this simply can't be right, Irv said. I know, but I saw it with my own eyes. Why were your own eyes checking out another man's penis, Max asked. Because he's Steven Spielberg, Jacob said. Why won't someone tell me who this person is, Tamir said. Because I don't believe that you don't know who he is. Why would I pretend, Tamir asked, entirely believably. Because it's your bizarre Israeli way of diminishing the achievements of American Jews. And why would I want to do that? You'd have to tell me, Jacob said. Okay, Tamir said, calmly wiping the remnants of six packets of duck sauce from the corners of his mouth. Whatever you say. He got up and headed in the direction of the condiments bar. You have to go back in and be sure, Irv said. You have to introduce yourself. You'll do no such thing, Max said, exactly as his mother would have. Irv closed his eyes and said, my core has been shaken. I know. I mean, what are we to believe? I know. All the while, we thought his Holocaust schlock was compensating for the Holocaust. Now it's schlock? It was always schlock, Irv said, but it was our schlock. But now, I have to wonder. Jacob said, well, look, it's not as if he isn't Jewish. But Jacob couldn't finish the sentence. Or he didn't need to. As soon as the fragment of the possibility entered the world, there was no room for anything else. I need to sit down, Irv said. You are sitting down, Max told him. I need to sit on the floor. Don't, Jacob said, it's filthy. Everything is now filthy, Irv said. In silence, they watched dozens of people balancing overstuffed trays, weave and dodge and never touch. Presumably, a higher life form would have its own version of David Attenborough. That person can make a great episode of a mini-series about humans featuring such hypnotic observing. Max whispered something incomprehensible to no one. Irv rested his head in his hands and said, if God had wanted us to be uncircumcised, he wouldn't have invented smegma. What? Jacob asked. I said, if God had wanted... No, I was talking to Max. I didn't say anything, Max said. What? Nothing, Irv said. Jaws is such a terrible movie. And then Tamir came back. They'd been too preoccupied by their apocalyptic speculations to notice how long he'd been gone. So here's the deal, he said. What deal? He has problems with urinary retention. He? Steve. Irv clapped his cheeks and squealed like it was his first visit to the American Girl flagship store. I can see why you assumed that I would know who he is. Very impressive resume. What can I say? I don't watch a lot of movies. There's no money in watching movies. A lot in making them, though. Do you know that he's worth more than $3 billion? Billion with a B? Really? Well, he had no reason to lie to me. But why did he have a reason to share? I asked. You asked how much he's worth? Yeah. And you probably asked if he's circumcised, right? Yeah, I did. Jacob embraced Tamir. He hadn't meant to. His arm simply reached for him. It wasn't that Tamir had gathered the piece of information. It was that he had all the qualities that Jacob lacked and didn't want, but desperately missed. The brashness, the fearlessness where fear wasn't required, the fearlessness where fear was required. The giving of no shits. Tamir, you're a beautiful human being. So? Irv begged. Tamir turned to Jacob. He knows you, by the way. He didn't recognize you, but when I mentioned your name, he said he read your first book. He said he considered optioning it, whatever that means. He did? Yeah, that's what he said. Oh, man, if Spielberg had made a film of that book, I'd exhume the lead, Irv said. Is he short-sleeved or what? Tamir jiggled his soda cup. Tamir? Well, we agreed it would be funnier if I didn't tell you. We? Steve and I did. Jacob gave him a shove, as spontaneous as the hug. You're bullshitting. Israelis never bullshit, Tamir said. Israelis only bullshit, Jacob said. We're family, Irv pleaded. Yes, and if you can't keep secrets from your family, who can you keep secrets from? Fine, I emancipate myself from the family. Just please, you have to tell me. Tamir scraped the remaining lo mein from his bowl and said, before I fly back. What? I'll tell you before I go. Can't be serious. Could he be serious? I can, Tamir said. Irv banged the table. I'll tell Max, Tamir said. An early bar mitzvah present. What he chooses to do with the information is his own business. You do know it's Sam's bar mitzvah, Max said, not mine. Of course, Tamir said with a wink. This is a very, very early bar mitzvah present. He put his hands on Max's shoulder and brought him close, his lips almost touching Max's ear, and he whispered, and Max smiled and laughed. So that is that. Entirely misrepresentative of the book, I'm afraid, but such is life. I think maybe we could use the time for questions and answers, if people have questions. I think there's a microphone floating around there. It's a very difficult thing because it's a long book, clearly, and it just came out. So there's some question about what are we going to talk about. But in the past, I found ways to make it work.
Actually, this is about everything is illuminated.
Okay.
So that may solve that problem. I'm asking the question because I had an experience personally, very much like what is described in the book. And my question is, how much of it did you glean from real life, and how much of it is your invention?
Was everybody able to hear that question? Okay. Normally, questions that begin with the word actually scare me. But that they're almost never questions, actually. But that actually was a question. So the book had some basis in life. My grandparents were from Eastern Europe. They were from that region. My grandfather was, in fact, apparently saved by a family. But that's about as much similarity as there was. I did go to that area. It's not exactly clear what I was trying to do. I wanted to see it with my own eyes. I wanted to talk to people. I suppose I wanted to, in the most sort of ambitious or idealistic or just dreamy sense, see if I could maybe even find the people that saved him or their descendants. In fact, there was nothing to see. I mean, you would have no way to know that a place ever existed. And this was once a very vibrant community of more than, I think, 4,000 people. So I had quite, in a certain sense, empty experience, but it was a certain kind of emptiness, you know, which inspired or demanded a filling in. And if I had found more, I doubt that I would have written the book. The book was a response to a need to write the book. You know, that's actually how it's been with... I was saying earlier that it didn't really take me 11 years to write this book. It took me 8 years to start it. It's because I didn't have a need to write it, or I didn't have a need to write any of what I was working on. I'd started a number of projects. The other day, I was moving some boxes around my house, and they all weigh a certain amount, and then I came upon one that weighed a lot more. And I opened the lid, and there's a tall stack of paper, and on the top it said, The Zelnick Museum, a novel, Jonathan Safran Foer. What's this? I looked through it, and it was just one of these projects that I had been working on. So, you know, the hardest thing about writing is not crafting nice sentences. Really, anyone can do it. If you give yourself enough time, if you devote yourself to it, if you make it your life, you can write nice sentences. You can also create believable characters, and you can structure a drama in a way that's engaging or suspenseful or whatever you want it to be. Those are questions of craft. They're not impossible. The hardest thing about writing is continuing to write, like persevering. I've taught for maybe a decade, and I've had a couple hundred students. I don't know exactly how many, 300, let's say. Probably 5 or 6 of them are still writing. It's not because they had more talent than the others. It's because they somehow resisted the impulse to stop, which is an incredibly strong impulse, not only if you are a kind of pre-professional or an unpublished writer, but if you're a Nobel Prize winner. You know, I don't know a writer who isn't tempted to stop all the time. So then the question is, like, why don't you stop? Some people are sufficiently motivated by panic or guilt or just their professional obligations. I feel plenty of panic and guilt, but they're not enough. They're just not enough. I apparently can live with the panic and guilt without finishing a book. I stop stopping when I want to, when there's something that I'm writing that I want to write. And then the question is, why would you want to write something? Which is a sort of mysterious question, actually, because sometimes you want to write it because it's fun. Sometimes you want to write it because it's thrilling. Sometimes you want to write it because it feels somehow personally necessary, because there's like a pressure on the inside that needs to be relieved by having material move to the outside. There are all kinds of reasons. I find, though, that if I... people will often ask me, like, do you have a schedule? Do you sit down for a certain number of hours every day? And do you have expectations you set for yourself? If I get to the point of such expectations, I will stop. Like, if I get to the point of it being an act of will, I will stop. It has to be an act of desire. So with that first book, Everything is Illuminated, the desire was to fill the emptiness that I discovered when I went to Eastern Europe.
Were you influenced by a book called Call It Sleep by Henry Roth? And if not, what is a book that has influenced you in your writing?
Well, influence is very subtle and mysterious. You know, it's one of those things that's easy to talk about, but difficult to talk about in a way that is true. I had this experience the other day where I like to play games with my kids, like word games, trivia, and at breakfast oftentimes. And we were playing a trivia game. And I asked my youngest son if he could name 5 different kinds of dinosaurs. And he said, yeah, absolutely, no problem. You got your Tyrannosaurus Rex, you got your T-Rex, you got your Tyrannosaurus, you got your Rex. And I could have saved a morning and spared everybody by just saying, congratulations, you named 5 different kinds of dinosaurs. But it's another thing I'm not fully evolved enough to let go of. Anyway, we went through that, and then he said, can I ask you a question? Do you think you asked me that question because there's a dinosaur on the back of my shirt? And I said, is there? And he turned around, and sure enough, there was a stegosaurus on the back of his shirt. And I honestly hadn't noticed it. It was the beginning of the day. I don't think I had seen his back to that point. And the front of the shirt was totally nondescript. And yet, obviously, I saw it. It would be impossible to make the argument, or be extremely difficult to believe the argument, that I asked him the question without having seen the back of his shirt. So, obviously, there's a lot of information that comes to us without our being aware of it. You know, the things that we see without knowing that we saw them, or hear without knowing that we heard them, or think or feel without knowing that we're thinking or feeling them. Those, to me, are the most interesting material and influences. Like, it's one thing to be an observant person and notice, but there are pretty extreme limitations on one's ability to observe. More interesting is what happens if you're just open to the kind of flow of influence and information. So, yes, there are some books, and you could name them, and Henry Roth is one of the authors, and Philip Roth is another one of the authors, and Joseph Roth is another one of the authors. That is true in one sense, but I don't know that. I think there's like a deeper truth which has to do with subtle influence and the kind of writing I'm most interested in and try hardest to like keep myself oriented toward is like writing that is inspired by subtle influences, which ends up, you know, leaving me surprised. I like the feeling of being surprised when I write. I don't have great faith in my abilities, per se. I don't think that I could write something that I wanted to write on purpose. It's going to have to be because of like accidents, weird rhymes, an openness to odd things that happen, and like giving them the benefit of the doubt. Like, you know that feeling, I'm sure, of getting into bed at the end of a long day, at the end of a long week. Your bed is warm, the room is cold. You're about to doze off. Maybe you've even had that thing, like the elevator dropping feeling, you know? And then like a little thought enters your mind. How totally inconvenient. And so you then have like two choices. You could get out of bed, find a pen and paper and write it down, or you could assume you'll remember in the morning, which has never in human history happened once. Or assume the thought probably isn't important, which I think is what most people do. Or at least it doesn't justify the effort to record it. So much of writing is like making the effort to record something whose importance is unknown. And often for me, it's these like subtle things, these weird sort of brain itches. Like, I don't know why I'm interested in that. In this book, you know, there's this earthquake in the Middle East. Where did that idea come from? It's very central to the book. I have no idea where it came from. I just had the thought at some point, and I, rather than dismissing it, I decided to record it and to pursue it. I pursued it all the way to the Geophysical Institute in Israel, and I spent a day with the guy who runs earthquake preparedness for the country, learned about it. 9 out of 10 of those efforts proved to be useless in the sense of not finding their way into anything that I write. But everything that I'm proud of that I've written has been the result of something like that. It's never been the result of an intention or a plan. It's been the result of pursuing something that whose worth was unknown.
So actually...
Uh-oh.
So I just have to share that I had a family dialogue around A Brush with Greatness too. And it, luckily, it didn't involve a penis. But I have a brainy, pale, small son who presented himself at a reading in Boston last week as your doppelganger, banger, is that the word?
Doppelganger,
thank you. And he was quite delighted at you signing his book with that. So that was our family discussion of our brother's greatness. So now I'm here today, and you'll be in Michigan next week, so we're all going to have our version. My question is... I was hoping for some acknowledgement that you had a memory of that, but evidently not.
Your son did indeed do that. Yeah. He came up and he said, I'm your doppelganger, which put me in a position like, okay?
To say something like, all Jewish boys look alike.
I'm pretty sure I said something just like that. Yeah.
Anyway, my question
But the weird thing was, then there's the person in line behind him who was like Father Time. He might have been 120 years old, stooped over, and he looked very much like the future version of the two of us. Which everybody acknowledged, including the old guy didn't hear it when I made the comment, but somebody went up to him and whispered and explained, and then even he acknowledged, you guys really, you are going to look like me one day.
I'll have to tell my husband that. My question was, I'm very appreciative and looking forward to the idea of seeing the many perspectives you're describing that happen in the book. The part about the Israel and the politics I'm a little nervous about, but I'm really...
Why are you nervous?
I'm glad that a lot of perspectives will be presented.
But what would the source of your anxiety be?
Oh, let's not go there.
No, really, I'm asking you. What would the source of your anxiety be?
You're making me sorry I asked.
That's not my fault. I ask for a reason, which is because people have a very strange reaction to the word Israel. Forget about the idea Israel, the reality of Israel, conversations about Israel. To use the word Israel is a political act, and it makes people nervous. And it's one of the, you know, I all the time have people say to me, you've written a very political book. And I'll say, really, what do you think the politics are? And they start to fumble and get nervous and say, well, political, I don't know. And it kind of goes nowhere. It's just worth acknowledging. I'm not putting you on the spot. It's just worth acknowledging that this is a subject that makes people nervous.
Right. And that's what I'm doing. I think it's to be supportive of Israel and be a liberal, which are both true for me, makes me, you know, anxious to hear how that comes out. But the part that I did want to talk about was the relationship, because they're talking about, you know, I'm picturing the Wiener cell phone kind of thing. So whatever happens, and there's this, you know, you can't go back from it. Thing that happens in this marriage.
Oh, Anthony Weiner. Is that what you meant? Okay.
I said the word penis before, okay. So I wasn't going to say
I honestly didn't get that for a little bit.
I would have gone straight for the right language. No, but what I'm looking forward to hearing about is the how you thought about the relationship and having, I'm assuming, to develop the character of Julia, that your wife in the story, developing both the female and the male perspective around that that trauma in the marriage and how that may or may not have impacted your sensitivity around those issues or around trust and marriage in your own life.
Oh no, I mean, it has no relationship to my own life, but in terms of the book, you know, I was trying to get her right as a character in the book, in the same way that I was trying to get Jacob right or the 13-year-old Sam right. And it is, in a certain sense, more of a challenge to get right somebody whose life circumstances are unlike your own. So it is, in a certain sense, harder to get an 80-year-old woman right or a person who lives in China, you know, because there's a lot of like details and journalistic material that has to be at least believable enough. Otherwise something's going to be undermined, but that's not really what books are about. You know, I remember at one of the first readings I did for my first book, someone, a young woman stood up and said, how did you get that 80-year-old man right? Because, you know, you're not an 80-year-old man. So how did you get it right? How did you know? And I said, well, how do you know that I got the 80-year-old man right? Whatever it is in you that knows that it's right was what was in me that got it to, at least in your sense, and your by your judgment, right. So I think we all rely on these sort of tests of authenticity, which actually aren't connected to, or they're not, they overlap with, but they are not the same as something being factually correct or accurate. Like, being believable is a little bit different. And in novel writing, sometimes in order to make something believable, you have to actually depart from a kind of journalistic accuracy. So one example might be, let's say, Oscar, the hero of my previous novel. If I had gone and interviewed kids about his age on a playground and taken dictation and transcribed it, it would be an unassailably true depiction of a boy that age. But it might not feel at all true. Yeah, so that distance between the truth as referred to in the world and the truth that is something each of us has inside of us, which we don't always share and we can't necessarily argue with, is really interesting, and it's what novels depend on. So I didn't feel any differently. I mean, everything in the book is sensitive. Otherwise, it wouldn't have passed that test. Otherwise, I would have stopped. When the book stops being sensitive to me, I start to lose interest in it. And you have to maintain such a high degree of interest and care over such a long period of time. And in that way, a book is like anything else in life that you care about, like a relationship, you know? You have to maintain a very high level of care for a long time. And there are so many incentives to stop. Some of it is just like natural atrophy of interest or emotions. Sometimes people say to me, why do you write about like highly sensitive things? Which is a question that is nonsense to me. Like, I assume every writer believes he or she is doing that. And if not, why are they, not only why, but how? How are they reaching the ends of their books? I think reaching the end of a book, any book, is like an amazing achievement. And when one of my students tells me they finished a book, I don't need to read it to feel a kind of like amazement that you were able to maintain that degree of care over that period of time. You know, great for you.
I was wondering if you could just speak to the title, which is a clear religious reference, and how that sort of came about.
So the title refers to the story of the binding of Isaac in Genesis, which begins, and God put Abraham to the test. He said, Abraham. Abraham said, here I am. And then God said, I need you to kill your firstborn, kill your son, your beloved son. And that's one way to interpret it is the test is the sacrifice. Another way is the test is how are you going to respond when I call your name? And the way Abraham responds is not just give me 5 minutes or what is it that you need or I'll get to you when I can. It's here I am, this kind of unconditional presence without any reservations. I don't need to know what you're about to ask of me. The answer will be yes. Then only a few sentences later, when Abraham is leading Isaac up Mount Moriah, Isaac starts to sense that something odd is going on because they have all of the materials for the sacrifice, but no sacrifice. And he says, my father. And Abraham responds, here I am. And it's a very paradoxical moment because you cannot be unconditionally present for a God who wants you to kill your son while being unconditionally present for a son who does not want to be killed. And so the book takes that kind of paradox of identity and brings it into this contemporary and quite domestic setting. I think that, you know, the book is really quite specific, culturally specific, but I think everybody understands those paradoxes. The paradox of being, let's say, a parent and a professional. It is untrue that you can be unconditionally present for both, which is why sometimes you miss a soccer game to go to a meeting, and sometimes you don't take a promotion in order to continue to have dinner with your kids every night. You give and you take. I think everybody who's in a marriage or in a serious relationship knows that there is some paradox between a kind of devotion to other and devotion to self. I think a lot of people, like our nervous Zionist in the middle, know that there can be a friction or anxiety or between one's, as she really put it herself, like religious values and secular values, or religious identity and secular identity. I feel that. A lot of people feel that. So most of the time, those tensions or paradoxes don't destroy life, and they don't even cause pain, and they're not even really noticeable. We just kind of negotiate, and we make it work. But then sometimes there are moments when you can no longer just negotiate and make it work, but you're forced to say, not here I am and here I am, but really here I am. I'm going to claim an identity at the expense of the other identity. So these two crises in the book, the domestic one, which is the discovery of the Wiener phone, and the earthquake in Israel, compel choices. I am in this marriage or I am not in this marriage. There's no other choice. I am going to Israel to fight or I am not going to Israel to fight. And, you know, it's probably unlikely that anybody in this room, I don't even know if it's a blessing or a curse to be confronted with such a situation where you have to claim an ultimate identity. But it might remind us of those kind of paradoxes that we think are sustainable, that we live our everyday with.
Characters reveal themselves before you start to write them?
Do any of my characters reveal themselves before I start to write them? I don't have any characters before I start to write them. I don't have anything before I start to write. I don't have anything. I mean, sometimes I will have that kind of itch I described, like, this might be fascinating in some way, but that's really the most that I have. I don't have a story to tell. I don't have characters. I don't have some voice that I've found. It's through the process of writing that I begin to come into contact with my ideas. Although ideas isn't even really the right word. It's something more like instincts, like controlled instincts that become useful over time. W.H. Auden said, I look at what I write so that I can see what I think. That's been my experience. I don't have a lot of... it sounds like a silly thing to say, but I mean it in the most serious way. Like, I don't have a lot of thoughts. I don't walk around with an interior monologue. I don't think big things. The only times that I think at all, frankly, are... when I am in conversation with somebody, basically when a context is created for thought. I mean, but this is true of like a lot of experiences in life. If you don't have a context for the experience never happens. So like having a kid reveals that in a lot of different ways, like being asked questions that are so utterly basic, you cannot believe you don't have a ready answer. Like, what do you think God is like? Jesus, I have no idea. I've never really thought about that. How could I have lived for this many decades and not have an answer to that question? It's not simply because the question is so complicated. It's because I'd never had a good context for thinking about it. And then the context was compelled by a kid. Novels compel, they create a context that compels me to actually engage with my actual thoughts and feelings as opposed to the like things I think or feel that I feel, which are usually something about who I want to be or who I want other people to think that I am, but they're not authentic. But when I'm open, not with some kind of plan or objective, but open to pursuing the things that for whatever inexplicable reason move me, then I have better access to myself.
So just from reading the opening spine and the some odd paragraphs in the couple of minutes since you took the stage, it seems like this book
You've been reading since I took the stage?
Well, I'm interested. I wanted to find the section that you were reading, and I also just am interested in your writing.
If you don't mind, just while you ask your question, I'm just going to...
It wasn't during the question portion necessarily. It seems that this novel is very similar and at the same time very different from a lot of your other works. And I just wanted to ask what you have gleaned from your previous works that you've brought to this particular piece and what you think you learned from this one that you are going to bring to your future works.
You know, I don't really know, and I don't even know if I'm the best person in the room to answer that question. Like, I don't know. I don't feel that I learn things exactly. I mean, clearly, like, there are things about craft that I learn, but as I've probably made obvious, craft is not that central to the way that I think about writing. I feel really exhausted and really depleted at the end of this book. I remember when I wrote my first book, we had the typeset manuscript and it was like about to go to the publisher last day to look through it. And I had an idea that I liked. And I remember thinking, save it, because maybe you'll write another book one day. And like, we need to have something else. This is now our only idea that you just thought of. But it won't fill 300 pages, but it's more than we had without it. And I thought, well, first of all, maybe you won't write another book. And secondly, like, maybe other ideas will come. So let's put everything in. In that introduction, there was a bit of a review that I haven't read, but a line about the book holds everything, something like that. It does not hold everything, but it does hold everything I had. And in terms of thinking about a lesson I might learn for a future book, it's really impossible for me to imagine right now writing again because I don't have anything. I know that I will again because I've now been through this experience enough times. And, you know, the good and bad thing about life is that things change and you have experiences and, you know, you lose things and you gain things and perspectives change and circumstances change. But I don't go... The only sense in which I'm interested in learning from my own writing has to do with learning about myself as a person, not myself as a writer. That distinction I've always found odd between myself as a person and myself as a writer. And yet it becomes increasingly like both like confusing and clear the further I get into my writing career, how utterly distinct those two identities are and how entirely embedded each is in the other. So thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.